My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome to Aquarium Drunkard Transmission. So glad to have you tuned in. This week on the show, I am joined by Kamei Oweya, better known as More Mother. As one half of the Black Quantum Futurism Collective, which she founded with Rashida Phillips, she's focused her considerable energies on, quote, the manipulation of space-time in order to see into possible futures, and or collapse space-time into a desired future in order to bring about that future's reality. As the front person of the incendiary jazz punk group Irreversible Entanglements, she's let it rip on a series of albums released by International Anthem and Don Giovanni. Last year's Protect Your Light found Irreversible Entanglements moving to the legendary Impulse Records. Along the way, she's released records under the More Mother banner, like 2021's Black Encyclopedia of the Air and 2022's Jazz Codes. Those were more melodic records, but her latest, The Great Bailout, out on Anti Records, is a record that functions a little bit like a sonic horror movie. It conserves these British acts of parliament that established massive loans, something like £20 million or $17 billion adjusted for present-day conditions, to compensate 46,000 slave owners who lost, quote, property because of the legal abolition of slavery in the UK. It's interesting to think about how radical an idea like reparation sounds until you realize that they've done it before, only they did it to repay the enslavers. Joined by guests like Lonnie Holly, Kyle Kidd, and Sisters of the Nitty Gritty, past Transmissions guest Anjul Bhatt Dawid delivers an absolutely breathtaking clarinet solo on this record. It finds More Mother transmuting jazz, noise, rock, folk, gospel, and classical music, melting it all down in a poetic churn. But before we get to my conversation with her, a little bit of housekeeping. Are you an Aquarium Drunkard member yet? We're working directly with our readers at Aquarium Drunkard, forming the Aquarium Drunkard membership. Head over to Aquarium Drunkard and subscribe so that you can keep this project humming along, delivering you mixtapes, interviews, radio shows, podcasts, and much more. We've been at it for nearly 20 years, and with your support, we'll be around in the decade to come. Oh, and we're doing another live transmissions episode at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles. Guest host Will Sheff of Okkervil River will be in conversation with author Sean Howe, discussing his book on High Times founder Thomas King Forsaad. It promises to be a conspiratorial, high-energy affair, with Will and Sean digging in. It's April 20th in Los Angeles, 420, so secure your tickets now over at the Philosophical Research Society and look forward to that episode soon in the feed. More Mother plays history and time like a science fiction story, so it was especially excited to bend in this temporal moment with her on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I hope you enjoy it. I'll speak with you a little bit more on the other side.
The drama, did you pay off the drama? Did you pay off the drama?
The poison of the tobacco.
Thank you.
and they will dare to do so.
I appreciate you taking the time. How are you today?
I'm all right. How you doing?
I'm doing good. This has been such an incredible and fascinating album to spend time with. Congratulations on it.
Thank you so much.
It must mean so. I was thinking about the sort of trajectory of this album, right? It started as a staged production, right? And then it was that in 2019. Is that when it took root?
Yeah, 2019. We went on tour with some members of the London Contemporary Orchestra. Yep.
What was it like returning to that material to start the process of putting it together for this album? How did that idea kind of occur to you?
What, to make an album?
Yeah, was it always in the back of your head while you were, you know, creating that and staging it live?
No, because we had recorded an album. But it was taking a while to get out, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I just said, oh, I'll just, let me just do a version of it.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, it's such a remarkable record. I found myself thinking a little bit about, I was just thinking about the sort of obscured histories of London and the really intense and cool way that the soundscapes both, you know, contrast and sort of create this intense world around your words. I found myself thinking of Alan Moore a little bit, you know, like, From Hell or something like that, thinking about...
Who is that?
He's the guy who wrote the book Watchmen, the graphic novel Watchmen, and V for Vendetta.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. I mean, I saw that movie, V for Vendetta.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and also did a track for one of his films, I think, with...
I remember that now. That was really cool with, who was the producer
on it? Broder.
Broder.
Yeah. I thought I heard that name before, yeah.
I remember being really excited to see you on that soundtrack. So that's a cool contrast right there. But anyway, yeah. It's a really incredible... it's an incredible work. Angel Bat David has been on this show before, and her clarinet on South Sea is something else, kind of out of this world. I found myself thinking.
I mean, yeah, she's incredible. And, believe it or not, the piece was even longer, you know.
Really?
I had to make some trims, which was so sad to do. But, yeah, it was even longer. So Angel's just a phenomenal musician.
Yeah.
And person.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting thinking about how your work you've stylistically been in different places, you know, at different times. You'll play around with the tone and mood and texture and all that stuff. But this album, it's kind of weird. I feel like it has moments of everything from your discography. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like it's like a summation of it or anything like that. But I feel
it doesn't have any hip hop. And it doesn't have rock on it at all.
That's true.
Not singing so much on it, you know. But this was made in 2020. I don't know if you remember all the records that I made in 2020, but that's Jazz Codes, that's Black Encyclopedia, that's Brass, that's the Bandcamp stuff I was doing. Besides the albums that I would have, that I would drop. I dropped the True Opera that same year. That was just a busy time for me. So it's really exciting to have this kind of chapter of my life finally be out and, you know, all this new stuff that I've been working on, have a chance for that to come out and really questions about, you know, musicians within the music industry and how much music are they allowed to release, when they're allowed to release. It's just been kind of interesting because I honestly tried to find other artists that were similar in my output and as far as genre ranging.
Yeah.
To see some other type of blueprint for this type of work, you know. And I haven't been able to really find that. So there's no blueprint of how it goes, of really how much music am I allowed to release, especially when most people are in one other side project. You know, I'm in several projects that can be full-time, that are full-time jobs. Right. I don't know anyone that's balancing, like, you know, from 3 to 4, 4 full-time jobs as musicians and creators. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Do you find that that question, you know, how much music is someone allowed to release? I find that, you know, something that really comes to my mind listening to this record a lot is so much of it draws on the inspiration that you draw from thinking about ways to consider time and the ways to bend time or manipulate time. And I feel like right now, people have this strange feeling about how much music is available to them that they don't feel like they have time enough to listen, you know, to everything that they want to hear. For you, is it a matter, I mean, you're talking about such an incredibly productive period. You know, you had so many projects flowing. Is that typical of your output? Do you normally have that much work sort of being generated at most times?
Oh yeah, I mean, and that kind of made me slow down a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, the frustration of wanting, of having stuff ready and it's not able to come out. You know, so that tends to be like, well, what's the point of making music right now? And who knows when someone's going to be able to hear it? And I was sitting with that for a little bit, you know, but then I got out of it.
Yeah,
because if that's what I love to do, then that's what I love to do. Who cares when it comes out or if it never comes out or how it comes out? You know, I can take a bit more agency on, okay, well, what can I do with this project? You know, instead of depending on the, you know, the typical, oh, I have it, let me give it to the label now, and then they'll tell me when it's going to come out. So it allowed me to just think a little bit more, you know, expansive with projects. Yeah. But I don't have that problem when you say, like, a lot of people say, oh, there's so much music to listen to. Now, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, jazz from the 70s and sound art from the 70s and stuff that I want to listen to. But it'll come to me when it's time for it, you know?
Yeah.
There's been
so
much music that I have just wasn't ready for at the moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean. And that's such a nice thing to be able to, that's one reason why I try not to get hung up on that notion. You know, among critics, there can be that feeling that you have to somehow keep up with everything. And it's like, it's kind of a fool's errand. You have to follow your gut and you just have to listen to what you feel called to, you know, and try to be expansive, push yourself to try things outside of your comfort zone. But this is a record that definitely, at certain moments, pushed outside of my comfort zone, you know, sonically.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw some young kid do like a YouTube review, like a short review of the record. And it was really interesting because this kid was like, usually I give scores, but I'm not giving this record a score. I don't think it's appropriate. And I like these kind of thoughts, you know, of approaches to be like, okay, I'm not going to compare this to Katy Perry. Maybe this is something else than what Katy Perry's trying to do. You know, I just pulled that name out of thin air, but you understand what I mean? Just,
I was going to make a joke that this reminded me very much of a Katy Perry record. a very parallel universe Katy Perry record, one where she never quit. She started making, who knows? Yeah, that's, but no, I know exactly what you mean. Like it's a record that asks that you approach it on its own terms. I think that's what, you know, is really the mark of something sometimes. It's like when there's no way to accept it other than for what it is, you know. I think mm-hmm. to listen to this record is to experience it. It's been a really powerful one for sure.
Thank you.
I was thinking about, you know, you're an American artist and you're talking about these different acts that took place in the UK, British Acts of Parliament, where essentially former slave owners post-emancipation were, it's essentially a form of reparations basically paid by the government to former slave owners, right? I found myself thinking about how in the United States, slavery is, there's no real like denying it, you know, there's no way to sort of obscure it the way that in the UK, it feels like there was some sense of wanting to whitewash or not fully explore the complications of slavery, you know, vis-a-vis the United Kingdom. When you first staged these shows, there was some protest, right? Is that right? I heard, read some rumbling.
No protests.
Okay. It certainly upset people, you mentioned, that there were upset, maybe it was comments on, you know,
an interview. No. It was, it wasn't involved with this performance. It was just an interview that I did on The Guardian.
I see.
And just people comment, not anything that
resulted in them actually paying any attention to the shows. Because of course they're not actually trying to engage with the art or anything like that.
Yeah, and plus within my work, I've always talked about these certain themes. Yeah. So that interview was in 2017, 2 years before I would even do the production. You know, right. So it was just talking about that we haven't truly understood the, you know, the residuals from slavery.
Right.
That's
right.
All I was saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the questions that this record asks about that are, mm-hmm. They're very, you know, they're demanding questions. They're hard questions to even consider in some ways. And I find myself going back again to that notion of the way that you're interested in time, you know. I think that I read this referred to as something like a non-linear word map. And I wondered if, you know, I don't necessarily want to ask you, like, can you break down for me?
No, I could speak to that.
Oh, yeah.
So within the, and I'll call it the orchestral version, it was three acts. Okay. So, it was really one long poem broke into three acts.
Yeah.
So when I'm like, okay, I can't just turn in an album of three long songs, what can I do? So I started to break it up into tracks. And it wouldn't be, you know, like in the orchestral version, I start with God Save the Queen.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So because of how I broke it up, you're coming into the piece like in the middle of it. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So it's not quite this beginning story of like 1610, 1492, Columbus saw the ocean blue, then, you know, Portugal and blah, blah, blah. So it's just, it's about the muckiness, the idea that this is messy.
Yeah.
It's not some single line, you know, even as we talk about it and you say, oh, you're someone that is coming from America talking about Britain, right? So let's just say the year was, you know, I don't know, 1210. Let's say it was the year 1510. Let's say it was the year 1620.
Right.
Okay. We start asking these questions. Well, How far is Britain from America? So it depends on where you are jumping on the timeline to say we're totally away from England. You know?
Yeah.
And the thing is, we're not, I don't believe this. Do you understand what I mean?
You don't believe that it's like that, that is some past occurrence. You're saying we're sort of still living with its ramifications, essentially, that we live in the world that was created through those historical actions. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like in conversation, it feels like, oh, the hands are washed. Just like we're talking about enslavement in America. You said, oh, it's hard for us to pretend that it didn't exist or to whitewash it in some way. But that's all it's, to me, that's all it's been all over the world. To me, it's just when you just talk about in 2020, when I made this record, people were still debating whether certain statues should come down.
Right.
People were coming together defending statues of this genocide. I don't know what you want to call it. You know, it seems like calling slavery does nothing because of the people still upholding these things, still debating, you know, rights or laws that were made in the 60s or in the so-called civil rights era and rendering them mute.
Right.
Reversing them as if this era was not even about anything. What was this? Why did they make these rules? I mean, and it's like for someone like me, I grew up in a place called Maryland. As writers and musicians, we look up to this place called New York. You understand?
Yeah.
First it was New Amsterdam. Now it's New York. Where's York at?
Right.
You know, I mean, right. Many people have to understand, where is York? So these things that are in our face every day, it's like, well, when do we, when I say jump on the timeline, that can mean several things. You were not, you don't know of what it was or what's the connection. We're starting to find that out right now with the renaming of streets and this and that. What are the connections? What does it mean if you have a neighborhood like Little Italy? What does it mean if you don't have a neighborhood of Little Africa or Little Nigeria or Little Ghana? What does it mean when we don't have these places around? So it's a lot of questions, you know? It's a lot of, it's so mucky. Do you know what I mean? Messy. We don't understand the connections all over the world. And it's nuts for something so horrific in our own town. Do you know what I mean? Our own country, our own soil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel like I read an interview with you from 2017 with the Vinyl Factory where you alluded to like the Mandela effect, which I think is trying to articulate some sort of truth, maybe in a strange way, in an abstracted way, or a weird, maybe incomplete way. But yeah, as you had asked, do I believe that the past is being obscured? Yeah, of course, right? Because it's absolutely manipulated by who's doing the telling and how they're doing the telling. So, you know, so when it comes to something like the Mandela effect, I think it is actually very funny that it probably is addressing some sort of semi-real truth, you know? And it's just hard to parse that out, of course, in our strange internet culture or whatever. You know what I mean? But people are able to very easily create their own idealized version of the past. So,
yeah, I mean, that's what map making is.
Yeah.
You know, that's why maps have to keep being remade because of this same kind of way of someone's intentions. It's a map of intentions.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because in some ways, I mean, you started making records as More Mother, I think, around 2016, if that's right.
Yeah, that's when
And obviously that was really the huge start of like a very strange and interesting reckoning that had like it's not like it really started then. That's when a lot of people who had previously tried to ignore the history were confronted with it in a more upsetting and visceral way than they might have expected.
Right.
But I do think that now, since then, over the years that have, you know, transpired since 2020, people do seem more interested in having real discussions about what capitalism and colonial, like what those things actually are. And it feels to me like they're less fringe topics to discuss. Does it feel that way to you as well?
But are you talking about in music, or are you talking about on the internet, on social media?
I guess maybe in popular culture writ large, you know, music or the discourse or whatever that is. I guess it's, I guess I don't super mean splitting the difference, because in music there's always been a history of it being explored, of course, you know. I just mean, does the average person seem more interested in having that conversation with you now as somebody who is making art about it?
I would say I was having more conversations about this during the DIY time.
Yeah.
Before, you know, signing with the label, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think there's so many dreams attached to becoming a musician or a performer, you know? And I feel like those dreams in popular culture seem to be more tied to pop star dreams than any type of political dreams. I feel, you know, you say popular culture, you know, and we have to talk about it. Like, I'm coming from a niche, you know, kind of music, where we're talking about jazz, experimental, the sound art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't see that as popular, you know?
Sure, sure.
So it's kind of tough, you know, because I just feel like, and I said this when Fetish Bones came out, that was the reason why it was called Fetish Bones. I felt like everyone is trying to do, and this is what I said, start their own business, but not in the business of our, you know, DIY examples, community-driven examples, and the examples that are taught by Harvard, are taught by the, you know, Donald Trump School of Business.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the kind of businesses I felt like the folks coming from 2016 to whatever popular music is now have been trying to do. You know, it's been this rush of allegiances. If you don't have, I mean, I don't even know, you know, by the you know, the blessing of, you know, just continuing to do what I love, but this race for so-called celebrity allegiances,
yeah,
is real. You know, I mean, back in the punk days, we just had to worry about this kind of faking poor, you know, these trust fund kids being, you know, taken care of. And we're like, right, you know, but they're just faking it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, now I just feel like it's a lot of, you know, when you can craft several different identities to be whoever you want and people believe what they see, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I just think it's a bit different, you know. But every day the consumer, someone in the consumer base wakes up a bit, you know. I was just, when I was leaving London the other day, a driver picked me up and he said, I can't believe I was a sheep for so long.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Something that happened in their government just shook him.
Right.
And woke him up, you know. But he said he just can't believe how long that he was going along with this, you know,
yeah,
this kind of right wing fear tactics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I
think about the song, you know, Compensated Emancipation. You talk about that. There's a lyric in there where you talk about how whiteness bridges the geographical. And I think that in some ways, that's what you were maybe alluding to a little earlier about, you know, how far exactly are these places from each other? Let's say
exactly,
rhetorically,
exactly.
You know?
We're thinking too small.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. A million plus artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. I can't help but feel like right now, you know, science and rationality, these are these tools, right, of like our existential frameworks, basically, right, in most of the places mm-hmm. where we live. And you talk on the album, I feel like, you know, you're talking about that, what happens when science loses touch with, like, maybe the other parts of being human, it becomes this inhuman thing, basically. And I think to some degree, it's, you know, science and rationality, all of those things are the way that people came up with these bogus mechanics of race science or whatever else, you know, created the very concept of race. But I wonder if you feel like right now, part of what is really an interesting struggle, I think, in our, like, basically in our political lives or maybe in societal, you know, a societal sense, is this sense mm-hmm. that, like, the purely binary, rational, yes or no, binary dot algorithm thing, it's not working for people. You know what I mean? Does that mm-hmm. register with you?
Yeah. I mean, we tend to think that, you know, if only we had certain things, everything would be better. But I think the conversation has moved away from human rights.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Basic human rights and who deserves it. I mean, when I say something like this, people act like that humanity was gifted to everyone. You know, some people were deemed savages, where this idea of calling someone these names.
Right.
Savage was the first big one. You call someone savage, oh, you could take away everything from them. You understand?
It's a dehumanization tactic. They don't count.
Yes. 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 So now, as we talk about basic things as water and housing as human rights, we're still debating this, you know?
Yeah.
This is still a debating, because they say, when we talk about unhoused people, they say, oh, well, they're hooked on drugs, right? We have to call them, we have to say all of these things to say why someone ends up on the street. But we understand it. So many of us understand it as, if you lose your job and you miss 3 or 2 months rent,
yeah,
you can be out. It's not a situation of anything else. I mean, even today, you know, we have a band group chat, and we've learned that 86, a lot of these record labels are laying off people today, you know what I mean? Mm. And, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of job it is. Do you know what I mean? It's not like these people are just working at McDonald's and they're not working hard. It could be anybody. Stories like that, you know, that anyone can lose their home, not just someone that has a low tier job or something like this, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But it's that thing of dehumanization that I think is so at the core of this album. And at least for me, that's what I kept being drawn to consider, you know. Maybe it's also because I keep thinking about the speech that Jonathan Glazer gave at the Oscars and thinking about, you know, the...
I don't know his speech. What did he say?
He directed that film, The Zone of Interest, and they had won something, and...
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
He basically said, how do we fight that kind of dehumanization that allows these things to continue, you know, directly in front of us? And I feel like that is such a hard question to be faced with, because it can feel impossible to imagine outside of those systems. But that's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to the tradition of free jazz. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You read a couple Sun Ra poems and you start to kind of recognize the way that you can imagine your way outside of certain frameworks, you know, if you are able to, if you're open to it or whatever. So anyway, I definitely think that the dehumanization you're talking about is so rampant in our culture that it feels omnipresent, you know?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a successful tool.
Right. Well, it wouldn't.
That's the thing. Yeah. What are these successful tools that strip people from humanity?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You grew up, you know, there's a couple, the way you say the word God on this record a few times sends shivers through me. Like, there are a few moments, you know, and I know you grew up in, like, the African Methodist Church, right? Is that the kind of, mm-hmm. that's the faith tradition that you grew up in? Did you have musical experiences early on in the church that were really formative for you?
I mean, as a kid, I was just all around, you know what I mean? But, yeah, I was in the choir.
Yeah?
I sung in the choir.
Would you say that's how you learned to sing, or were you already singing pretty frequently on your own?
I think I always loved music. My family always loved big singers. And I remember, like, my sister and I would sing, you know?
Yeah.
The songs we learned at the choir together and the ones that we really liked.
Yeah.
My family always loved music. So I was always rapping young and singing and stuff like this, but never like, you know, my mom's favorite singer was Patti LaBelle. You feel me?
Sure.
That wasn't something that I was like, oh, I'm going to be a singer.
Right. Right.
I was more of I like sports. I was more into sports as a kid, but music was just a big part of it. Everything. Singing wise, enjoying music and, you know, singing along to stuff. Not playing instruments. I mean, we had turntables, so like Salt and Pepper and things like that, that was using turntablism.
Yeah.
Was like really important, but it's just like the love of just songs. My grandmother was in the choir. My dad was in the choir. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just certain things that, you know, it's really like cool. And always loved that it was African. You know,
well, yeah, and that
an African church,
and that the church gave you a framework to sort of understand African cultures outside of the country here, you mean, to some degree?
Well, no, I mean, just as I mean, I've always was interested,
yeah,
you know, since I was super little,
yeah,
you know, learning about, Native American indigenous cultures, learning about Caribbean culture, coming from a place called Aberdeen and Maryland, these kind of things, seeing all these signs of Europe.
Yeah, yeah. I was curious about, you talked about looking for, you know, sort of for like antecedents, other artists who are walking similar paths to you, and looking around and not seeing so many. I couldn't help but think about, though, the way Lonnie Hawley, you know, is somebody who so powerfully bridges the worlds between poetry and music.
But by no means in saying that, I mean, in a particular case, Lonnie Hawley is like one of my favorite artists, you know?
Well, yeah, yeah.
He's prolific. he creates more art in me. Just on a regular journey, he creates a lot of art. You know, I just went on tour with him. So, I mean, there is that similarity because we're both visual artists as well. We have this visual art practice.
Right. And his the way he, you know, I guess maybe you could use the term like spontaneous writing or automatic writing in some sense when it comes to what he does.
Oh, yeah. No, in those ways, yes.
You feel some connection to him in that way, too, because a lot of times your stuff will start sort of that similar open channel kind of way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we both pull a lot from our family and our life experiences and our spiritual connections to nature and the world around us, our spiritual connection to humanity. Oh, definitely. Lonnie Holly reminds me a lot of myself.
Yeah.
But he's just like, damn, he creates. He doesn't have to get comfortable to create. Now, I'm not saying that I have to be comfortable, because that's how I started off in punk, making myself as uncomfortable as I possibly can on stage and then seeing if I can perform. But he does it in the grumpiness of transit. He does it and he finds these kind of unique silences.
Yeah.
Or he creates these unique silences to create work, even if he's in a van full of 10 people. He's really good at that.
Yeah, it's funny to think about him almost as somebody who is just living artistically, you know? I mean, I've had the chance to see him live and to speak with him a few times, and to talk to him about his songs, he'll start talking to you about some of his earliest memories of life, you know what I mean? And you're like...
Yeah, definitely.
And then, but at the same time, in this beautiful paradox... Sometimes he'll do a poem and then he'll be like, well, that's that. It's just gone now. Like I'm never gonna say those words again, you know? So I feel like he's such a fascinating character, and I love the way he works with you on this record. I enjoyed the work that we had Vijay Iyer on the show as well, and his playing on All the Money is really fantastic. When did you first connect with him?
I did a show with him and Arouge and Tyshawn in New York.
Mm.
And it was just so good. It was just so good. It was good on so many levels. And then I would perform again with him, and it was just incredible. So we knew we had a kinship there. He's someone that, you know, is a positive person. And so we knew we had something, and that we could have a relationship of trust, you know? So, it was really about, I didn't pine over this of who I would work with. I had just come off of this intense tour from 2016 to 2019, basically to the pandemic. So I just thought about people that were like good, I thought good people, great composers, and no nonsense, no like ego and drama.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's such an incredible collection of collaborators. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the origins of the final song on the record, right? It's I don't know if I'm gonna say it right. Spem in Allium?
Yeah, it's not named after that famous composition. I just connecting the storylines. I had Radwan. I don't know if you know Radwan from Jerusalem in My Heart.
No.
Oh, it's a great band. It's a great band. You probably do know them in some way, because they've played they did Legasu. They've been curators for certain things. So I just really wanted to include everyone. Yeah, it's a so-called record about Great Britain, Yeah, I'm so-called coming from the continent of North America. But the way that I've made all these connections and brought all these people together and sounds together, it makes it a world story.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that
yeah.
I want people to make, you know, the connection. Because if it was a simple America this and then England that, that makes it too small. And you need to see how, you know, massive this thing actually was and how it just didn't change hands once. It continued and continued to change hands, you know?
Yeah.
So you could have one area owned by, you could have the Italians owning an area, then it gets switched to the Germans. Then from the Germans, it goes to the French. And then from the French, it goes to the English. Do you understand? This is how so many places, countries in Africa took place.
Yeah.
Where it wasn't just, oh, here is the big bad man and his big bad outfit. And now it's over. The situation between the South and the North is healed. Now the Civil War that's over. No, we see how it continued and continued and continued.
Yeah.
So what do you do to stop people from fighting for liberation? All kinds of these tools have been used. But if we stay in a silo about it, we cut off other people's struggles.
Yeah.
We cut off the conversation with Australia. We are in conversation with Australia.
Right.
Why don't we think that it just goes from here to there, and then that was all we need to talk about, the so-called triangle, right? Because that's what everyone's talking about, the triangle of slavery. There ain't no damn triangle.
Yeah.
The triangle in North Carolina. Yeah, okay, there's these major ports, these major points, but it's so much bigger, okay? We're talking about clothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're talking about cotton. We're talking about tobacco.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sugar, all those. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I love that video that Colleen Smith made for All the Money, because it portrays it like one of those true crime podcast vibes. You know what I mean? Like, I found myself thinking like, oh man, I feel like I got to subscribe to this and give it a rating in the Apple podcast app or whatever, but it's so good.
That's super cool.
I loved that video, but it lays it out in that way that you're saying, where it's like, you know, it's almost like it's all connected, and it sounds that sounds hard, you know, for people to like conceive of these systems that are so labyrinthian, but at the same time, that's what it is. It even goes down to the way we think about things, you know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
even if we somehow fixed all of the every single economic disparity or whatever, it's like, if these ideas still existed somewhere in the back of our heads, they'd manifest in some other way we have to deal with, you know?
And yeah,
I feel, I don't know, that's why I feel like it's an important you know, whatever. I once had a great conversation with Hari Kunzru, the writer, who he wrote a great book called White Tears, and okay. it's a fictional book, but we were talking about jazz music, and he was like, you can be a racist and listen to, you know, Pharoah Saunders. Like, you can still be like, you know, don't kid yourself into thinking that if you listen to the right music or whatever, you've actually interrogated all of these things. But all I could say was, well, yeah, but still, Pharoah Saunders is a pretty good start in the direction of, you know, I don't know, unpacking that stuff, if you're able to go that. And I don't know. I just think in terms of using, I've heard you reference free jazz as like a liberational tool. And I do think that there's a quality of it that is that, you know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, definitely. But this is what's happening with jazz right now.
Mm.
You know, I feel like it's the same, you know, racial, you know, constructs or class constructs. That's a tribute to it, you know?
Yeah.
This thing of, oh, we wait till someone dies and now we can tell our story. of what it was. Sun, you know, Sun Ra. Sun Ra wasn't, you know, this figure as he is now, back when he was playing.
No.
But you're not going to hear that. You won't hear this. You won't hear his truth. You're going to hear somebody else's truth.
Yeah.
And what do? They wait till you die so they can make more money off of you. This is something that I feel all the time. Okay? You're never going to be given this amount of respect. And it's, and right now, they're saying we're too far out.
Right.
You're too far out. If I'm too far out, who's allowed to be in? Who's allowed to be in? Who's allowed to be out? And when did being too far out with jazz be something that is not serving jazz no more, that the gatekeepers do not want anymore?
Right.
Okay. And then who are these so-called gatekeepers? How do they still allow to be in the position when they're, you know, stifling the creative freedom, the liberation technology that is jazz?
Yeah.
These are the things that we have to continue to deal with. But it's not, you know, what? I'm a bad guy if I start saying this.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah. Well, if that is the case, I think that it's kind of a necessary bad guy role that you're playing. but I will say that in terms of talking about being too far out, you know, you brought up Sun Ra, and I listened to the first time I listened to the Irreversible Entanglements Nuclear War recording, I was on an airplane.
That's cool.
And it was a wild ride. It was just, you guys do such a, you like the intensity of that recording is so cool. And in its own way, part of what I thought about was like listening to Jazz Codes, listening to The Great Bailout, listening to that to get ready for this talk. You know, the intensity that I hear on that Irreversible Entanglement song is specific, but The Great Bailout is just as intense. It's just in different ways, you know, very, very different mm-hmm. layers. So I think that that's such an incredible, you're really on this remarkable run right now. And I feel like very few people are putting it out there the way you are. And I really appreciate you taking,
I appreciate that.
I appreciate you taking time to talk about it and to, you know, parse some of this stuff out with me. I definitely feel like, you know, next time you come on, Lord willing, we could talk about just science fiction the whole time. Cause I feel like, I keep thinking about, you know, there's that line that you have on this record about, hang on, I've got it in my notes. I don't want to screw it up and say it wrong. But you say, like, you know, you, me, we are the invention of time travel. The first invention. Do you know the line I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I am, you are, the first form of time travel discovered. And I was like, man, I'm going to be thinking about that line for weeks.
Wow, that's cool. But, you know, that's just what we've been talking about, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether it's Sun Ra, whether it's Coltrane, you know, I got this Coltrane t-shirt on right now,
oh,
you know?
Yeah, that's incredible.
But the guy sells these vintage t-shirts for enough to pay your rent.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, if these guys only knew what was going on today, you know? But that's about understanding how valuable the things we're doing now can be for the future.
Yeah.
So yeah, I appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and I hope you have a good rest of your Sunday.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to checking it out. Right. And thank you for your time as well.
Thank you. Be well.
Thanks for checking out Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I write, host, and produce the show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton, and our music comes from Frank Mastin. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett, and our show's executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35 at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, each and every Wednesday night. Aquarium Drunkard is supported by its subscribers, so head to Aquarium Drunkard now and subscribe to make sure that you continue to get our high-quality, independent music journalism delivered direct to you from everybody at Aquarium Drunkard. Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. All right, don't neglect to get your tickets for Sean Howe and Will Sheff of Okkervil River doing a special Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions live guest pod over at the Philosophical Research Society. Get your tickets now and enjoy that 420 event. I will talk with you again soon. This transmission is concluded.